90.1 FM Burnaby, independent campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. We also stream online at cjsf.ca and listen to podcasts of our programs and our website.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, Israel's 57-year military occupation of Palestine is unlawful, the world court rules, and it must come to an end.
The court, by 11 votes to 4, is of the opinion that the state of Israel's continued presence in the occupied territory is unlawful.
Will Israel abide? Will countries like Canada enforce it?
We all know that Israel's going to ignore it. So the question is, what are the other countries, including Canada, going to do? And based on the Prime Minister's statement, the answer is nothing.
Washington certainly won't. Perpetual occupation of other people's lands is an activity the U.S. supports, defends, and engages in all around the world.
U.S. military bases abroad are kinds of mini colonies, this growing collection of U.S. military bases on other people's lands that is larger than that of any people, country, or empire in world history.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. On July 19th, the International Court of Justice in The Hague issued a historic ruling. In an 83-page advisory opinion addressed to the UN General Assembly, the UN's top court declared that Israel's 57-year belligerent occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, is unlawful and that Israel must terminate it in short order. The self-declared Jewish state must also stop building settlements, the ICJ advised the United Nations, evacuate all its settlers, let Palestinians return to their lands, and compensate them for their losses and damages suffered. The last time the ICJ issued an advisory opinion on the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict, back in 2004, it focused on the separation wall Israel was building, largely on Palestinian land. The wall was unlawful, the court declared, an infringement of the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination in their historic homeland, and it had to come down. Israel ignored the order, and the international community hasn't enforced it. ICJ advisory opinions are non-binding. They do carry enormous judicial authority, however. Here's what the ICJ's advisory opinion ruling sounded like, read out by the court's Lebanese president, Judge Nawaf Salam.
I now read in English paragraph 285, which contains the operative clause of the opinion. For these reasons, the court, one, unanimously, find that it has jurisdiction to give the advisory opinion requested. Two, by 14 votes to one, decides to comply with the request for an advisory opinion. By 11 votes to four, is of the opinion that the state of Israel's continued presence in the occupied territory is unlawful. By 11 votes to 4, is of the opinion that the state of Israel is under an obligation to bring an end to bring to an end its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory as rapidly as possible. By 14 votes to 1, is of the opinion that the state of Israel is under an obligation to cease immediately all new settlement activities and to evacuate all settlers from the occupied Palestinian territory. By 14 votes to 1, is of the opinion that the State of Israel has the obligation to make reparation for the damage caused to all natural or legal persons concerned in the occupied Palestinian territory. By 12 votes to 3, is of the opinion that all states are under an obligation not to recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, and not to render aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by the continued presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory. By 12 votes to 3, is of the opinion that international organizations, including the United Nations, are under an obligation not to recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory. By 12 votes to 3, is of the opinion that the United Nations, and especially the General Assembly, which requested this opinion, and the Security Council should consider the precise modalities and further action required to bring to an end as rapidly as possible the unlawful presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Nawaf Salam, presiding judge of the International Court of Justice in The Hague, reading out the operative portion of the court's advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation of Palestinian territories this past July 19th at the Peace Palace in The Hague. Item 7 of that operative, passed by a vote of 12-3, declared that, quote, all states are under an obligation not to recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, and not to render aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by the continued presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, end of quote. Will the UN's most powerful member states honor that obligation and cut Israel off? The U.S. certainly won't. How about steadfast U.S. and Israeli ally Canada? In search of wisdom on this thorny question, the GPM reached out to Peter Larson. Larson is the chair of the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine and the author of a weekly newsletter called Canada Talks Israel-Palestine. Over the past decade, Larson has taught a course about the Middle East at Carleton University and has taken groups of Canadians on tours up and down occupied Palestine, guiding them through the complexities of Israel-Palestine's so-called conflict. GPM reached Peter Larson in Ottawa. Hello, Peter Larson. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor again.
Always a pleasure, David. Thank you.
Peter, the International Court of Justice rendered its advisory opinion on July 19th, the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation of the occupied Palestinian territories, now into its 57th year, and ruled astonishingly that the occupation is unlawful. How has the Canadian government responded?
Well, the Canadian government didn't respond for a while. It took a week to respond. And finally, Prime Minister Trudeau issued a joint statement with the Prime Ministers of Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, and basically ducked what the court had said, namely that the countries that are signatories to the court have to enforce the advisory opinion. We all know that Israel is going to ignore it. So the question is, what are the other countries, including Canada, going to do? And based on the Prime Minister's statement, the answer is nothing. We have said that Israel must listen to the concerns of the international community, but there were absolutely no statements about what Canada might do to enforce the advisory opinion.
But the statement by Trudeau and the leaders of Australia and New Zealand, if I understand correctly, was that urging or calling upon Israel to react substantively to the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion. And I thought, well, you know, item 7 of the operative said by 12 votes to 3, 15 judges of the International Court of Justice, by a vote of 12 to 3, the court is of the opinion that all states are under an obligation not to recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of the State of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, and not to render aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by the continued presence of the State of Israel in occupied Palestine. So if Israel has to respond substantively, and Trudeau thinks it should, by the same token, Canada has to respond substantively, doesn't it?
Of course. Of course. And they ducked that completely by basically tut-tutting and saying Israel should do better. But we have there's a whole range of things that Canada could or should have done and still can do to start to pressure Israel towards implementation of the advisory opinion. But clearly Canada is, for the moment, not intending to do that.
And it isn't so much to pressure Israel. I mean, pressuring Israel is one thing, but Canada has its own obligations. What do you think Canada should do or must do?
Well, there are a couple of obvious things right off the top. I mean, just easy things. Canada has a free trade agreement with Israel. We could easily declare, completely within Canada's purview, that we are going to suspend the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement until all the court's recommendations have been implemented. Canada imports goods that come to Canada produced in the West Bank by settlers. We could ban everything produced by settlers in the OPT outright. Another thing is that right now Israelis who come to Canada do not need a visa, and that includes Israeli settlers. Well, Canada could change that so that Israelis coming to Canada have to have a visa, and we could deny visas to Israelis who are living in the occupied territories. Those are three things that are totally within Canada's purview and totally reasonable.
And Canada, the official Canadian government position is that settlements are illegal. This has been Canada's position for years, that settlements are in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention and a hindrance to the two-state solution, which Canada says is absolutely essential. But Canada actually renders aid and assistance to the settlements, enables settlements to sell their products in Canada, tariff-free, no less.
That's right.
And it grants charitable status to Canadian organizations that aid and assist the settlements.
Well, there has been some interesting developments on this, not thanks to the Canadian government, but there has been a decision by CRA, the Canadian Revenue Agency, that the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, can no longer have charitable status on the grounds that it has actively raised money in Canada with a charitable tax-free status to help the Israeli military. This was a decision by the CRA. No doubt it will be appealed and there'll be some fight over it, but it certainly is a flag for Israel.
And Canada engages in arms trade with Israel. Canada engages in quote-unquote security cooperation with the Israeli military and the Israeli police, who are actively operating in the West Bank in occupied Palestine.
That's absolutely true. The total amount is not huge, but it certainly is there. And the Canadian government has made a decision that it's not going to sell any more military equipment to Israel. I don't know starting from what date that's going to be put into effect, and what it will define as military-related equipment is another issue.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of things Canada could do. Like, there is no insurance company, no corporation in Israel, no university, no technology company that doesn't engage in work in the occupied territories. And so Canada could issue an advisory to Canadian banks and financial institutions and insurance companies and private corporations that they henceforth could be penalized for doing business with counterparts in Israel who are engaged in Israel's occupation.
As you know, David, there were a number of university-based protests, encampments that often had as their, this at the University of Ottawa, at McGill, at Toronto, and elsewhere, that had as one of their key demands that the universities disconnect from Israeli universities or disinvest from Israel. Those demands are ongoing. I think that in general, the protests have taken on a different form now, but the Canadian government could certainly issue a declaration to Canadian universities that they discourage joint work with Israeli universities, or that they encourage universities to cut back or eliminate their investment in Israeli corporations. That's something that provincial governments could do as well, because, as you know, universities in Canada come under provincial government.
So what's the buzz in the House of Commons? Has there been any buzz in the wake of the July 19th advisory opinion? Is anybody from the New Democratic Party or from the Greens or anyone else, people within the Liberal Party, speaking out in favor of Canada imposing sanctions on Israel?
We're in, as you know, we're in summer recess now. Most members of Parliament are off, either having holidays or back in their various constituencies. I haven't seen in the paper any reference to statements by members of Parliament of any house urging the Canadian government to take a more substantial... I've seen, of course, calls from Palestinian human rights organizations like CGPME, but I'm not aware of anything coming from Canadian politicians.
Why does Canada render aid and assistance to Israel that's in support of its occupation, in support of the settlements? I mean, to be the born yesterday guy, Canada claims to be a rule of law nation. Justin Trudeau, no one declares the sanctity and the virtuousness of the international rules-based order than right. Justin Trudeau. Why does Trudeau follow this policy? Joe Biden is an avowed, passionate Zionist, but Justin Trudeau? I mean, why doesn't Justin Trudeau take a stand?
Well, I think if you try for a minute, David, to put yourself in Trudeau's position, I sometimes use this as an act of imagination. Imagine Trudeau asks me to be in charge of our Israel-Palestine policy. I say, well, that's great. He said, but before you take it up, here are some considerations I want you to keep in mind. Number one, United States, our biggest trading partner, our biggest military partner, is very much in favor of Israel. So please, anything you do, don't get us cross-threaded with the Americans, because that could have potential very significant impact on our economy, and people get angry over that and now pay the price for it. Secondly, don't forget that the Liberal Party needs funds. Liberal Party does not have very many Arab or Muslim members, but we have quite a few Jewish members. And so whatever you do, please don't upset the Zionist lobby in Canada. And the third thing is, remember that Canadians are skittish about Arabs, about the hijab, about Islamic terrorism and so on. So don't do anything that looks like we're supporting terrorism. And so the point is that we actually can do very little about what's going on over there. Why would Trudeau risk important negative consequences by speaking out over an issue on which Canada has very little leverage? So that's my view. I don't think it's just the Israel lobby or the Jewish lobby. I think that's a factor, but I think there are other issues at play as well.
But in my mind, I think that if Canada, the Canadian government, were to take a really strong stand vis-a-vis Israel's actions in Gaza and its occupation of the West Bank, by doing any of these things, by banning settlement products, I mean, how easy would that be? So obviously would Canadian recognition of Palestinian statehood, which would be, you know, much more symbolic than banning the importation of settlement products, although Israeli export of settlement products to Canada is just a drop in the bucket economically for Israel. So even that would be kind of pain-free for Israel, largely. It would be hugely symbolic, but it would create really positive reverberations around the world.
Well, David, there are two things here. First of all, you're speaking from a moral position with which I totally agree. I'm trying to analyze why the government doesn't do this, and I don't think it's because Mr. Trudeau particularly likes either Netanyahu or Israel. One thing Canada has done, and a good example is this most recent statement by the Prime Minister, which was done jointly with Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. We don't know what were the negotiations between Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, but they did come up with a statement. Canada could have just ignored the decision of the International Court of Justice, but they did make a statement. So if you do it with like-minded countries, that gives you a certain level of protection. The other thing you just raised, I think, is very important. I could have mentioned it in my list of things that Canada could do. Canada could recognize the state of Palestine. As you know, David, there's 136 countries around the world that currently recognize the state of Palestine. Very few of the Western European countries. Just recently, four more did so, including Ireland and Spain and a couple others. So Canada could undertake to recognize the state of Palestine. Once again, that would be a symbolic gesture because it wouldn't change very much on the ground. Canada didn't do that, but it did something else that was, I think, significant. Before the decision by the ACG, Canada said that we could envisage recognizing the state of Palestine and that we no longer hold that this has to come about as a result of negotiation with Israel. Canada's prior position was that we will recognize the state of Palestine once they come to agreement with Israel. And that statement to people who don't pay attention sounds good, but in fact, it's kind of like saying Canada accepts a woman's right to divorce as long as her husband agrees. It really means that there's no recognition at all. Well, Canada's changed its position on that, and we're saying it would no longer require Israeli agreement for Canada to recognize the state of Palestine, but they did not say what the conditions were, what the criteria were. So there is a little bit of movement going on. I don't think it's true that Canada is not responding at all, and I think that's partly as a result of the massive demonstrations we've had, statements by churches and unions and so on and so forth. But it certainly hasn't gone as far as it could go, and not as far as either you or I would like it to.
And Canada's voting record at the United Nations is abysmal in terms of its support for justice and peace and the rule of law in Israel-Palestine. Canada routinely votes alongside the United States, Israel, and those South Pacific nations.
Right.
Even opposing the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. For whatever it's worth, Canada could start voting in favor of resolutions in the UN General Assembly.
That's right. And while Canada does now officially recognize Palestinian right of self-determination, but this most recent statement issued with Australia and New Zealand say we remain unequivocal in our condemnation of Hamas. And then it goes on to say we see no role for Hamas in the future governance of Gaza. Well, that's a flagrant contradiction to the notion of the right of self-determination, because the right of self-determination would mean that the Palestinians have the right to choose which political parties they want or don't want in their governance. So to say, for Canada to say, we see no role for Hamas, is a stark violation of the right of self-determination.
Remember some years ago when Chrystia Freeland, who at that time was foreign minister, vowed that to a gathering of the Israeli Foreign Policy Institute or something like that, that Canada would be, if Canada got a seat on the Security Council, it would be an asset. It would act as an asset for Israel, quote unquote. It suggested that there was more than just simply, that supporting Israel was more than just simply a political calculation, that it was an ideological stance, that just like the United States and other Western nations, Canada sees Israel as a bastion of Western imperialist supremacy in a dark, dangerous world filled with Muslims and extremists of all kinds, that Israel is the light of the world in that part of the world and represents everything that the United States sees itself as being, a settler colonial state. There's a deep identification.
Yeah, and I don't think they would recognize themselves in your phrasing it that way, but I think you're basically right. We think of Israel as one of us, people like us, and we think of the Palestinians as one of them. That's true. We don't like, it's kind of close to a classic liberal Zionist position. We don't like a lot of the things that Israel is doing, but basically we think Israel needs to be protected, and we want to play a role protecting it.
So, you know, taking out your crystal ball or looking down into your teacup at the leaves, tea leaves kind of swirling around, what do you think Canada's going to do?
What we do about the ICJ, for example?
Well, yeah, Israel-Palestine, like how to, yeah. You know, the ICJ, and then, you know, the International Criminal Court is about to slap arrest warrants on Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant if the pretrial chamber approves Karim Khan's application for arrest warrants. This was another interesting thing that somebody, Melanie Jolie, was asked, would Canada execute arrest warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli leaders? And can't recall what she said exactly, but basically she said yes.
Yes, and we'll see what happens. I think many people expect that there will be an arrest warrant issued shortly, and we'll see what Canada says about that. And I think, once again, Canada will always be triangulating. I mean, first of all, about what the Americans think. I'm sure the calculation in the Prime Minister's office is that we can't go very hard against the Americans. So that'll be we'll be asking them what they're doing. We also triangulate against what our allies are doing, what they call like-minded. What are the Europeans doing? It'd be a lot easier. My understanding is that even Germany and France have said that should the ICC issue an arrest warrant against Netanyahu, they would, as members of the ICC, they would enforce it. Well, if a number of countries say that, I think that Canada would go along with that.
So to wrap this conversation up, Peter, do you see Canada taking steps to abide by Operative Statement 7 of the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion? Do you see Canada moving slowly towards terminating aid and assistance to the settlement enterprise and to the occupation?
I don't see Canada leading the pack, but Canada, I don't think, will resist. So I think if Europeans start moving in that direction, Canada will go along. But I don't think Canada will be pushing hard for this.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor, Peter Larson.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for the work you do. You bring a fresh perspective, and it's very useful. Have a good day, David.
Peter Larson is chair of the Ottawa Forum on Israel-Palestine. His weekly Canada Talks Israel-Palestine newsletter features interviews with informed guests and differing views on the origin of this so-called conflict. We'll link to Canada Talks Israel-Palestine at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. An astonishing fact. In the 248 years since the United States of America became an independent republic, the U.S. has only been at peace for about 11. The United States of War, you could call it. David Vine does. Vine, a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., has recently completed a third in a trilogy of books about Washington's fondness for permanent war and about the role military bases play in its ceaseless war-fighting pursuits across North America at first, then all around the world. The GPM reached David Vine in Oakland, California. Hello, David Vine. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hi, David. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
David, can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are.
I'm a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C.,
and this new book of yours, well, it came out last year, The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State, is the third in a set.
It is. It's the third in a trilogy. The first book was and is called Island of Shame, which is a book about one military base, the military base on Diego Garcia, an island that very few people have heard about, in the middle of the Indian Ocean, where to create a base in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the U.S. government, with the help of the British government, forcibly removed an entire indigenous people. And that book led me to look at what happened to those people, the Chagossians, who are still struggling to go home, and the larger network of U.S. military bases that encircle the globe. And that led to my second book, the second in the trilogy, called Base Nation, which investigated the broad impacts of the United States government maintaining hundreds upon hundreds of military bases around the globe and hundreds of thousands of troops since World War II. And that then led to the third book in the trilogy, The United States of War, that takes on the larger war system, the larger war machine that U.S. military bases abroad are a fundamental part of, and the long history of wars that the United States government has waged basically since independence.
And so that's a good jumping off point for my next question, which kind of brings us to a pair of really interesting numbers that you present in your book, which are kind of astonishing. And I would reckon that not a whole lot of Americans are really aware of this, that over the course of the how long, two